May it please the court, my name is Jordan Factor, registration number 38126, representing the appellants. With me at council table is Elizabeth Bryans. When should a reasonable person investigate whether his insurance company has failed to offer him coverage that it was statutorily obligated to offer? The court below, relying on a decision of another division of this court, cited three events that would cause an individual to investigate. First is when the individual receives a PIP fact sheet. Second is when the individual retains counsel. And then third is when the individual exhausts the available benefits under the policy. None of those three events ought to trigger the running of the statute of limitations. And I'd like to address each in turn. The first is the receipt of the PIP.
Perhaps you could suggest what should trigger the event.
Yes, Your Honor. In general, what triggers the running of the statute of limitations is when the plaintiff possesses all facts needed to know that they have a claim. That's going to vary from case to case.
Or facts that would put a reasonable person on notice of inquiry.
Yes, Your Honor. Facts that would put a reasonable person on notice of inquiry that the insurance company failed under its obligations under the no-fault statute.
And I take it your position here today is premised on the contention that Murray is wrongly decided.
Yes, Your Honor. And to answer Judge Ney further, when the statute of limitations begins to run is a fact-intensive analysis that's going to differ from case to case, even within the expanded PIP context. And we're not suggesting that there's one event that triggers the running of the statute for all expanded PIP cases. Given the 10 plaintiffs who are in this case, the statute began to run when they received notice in 2007 of the reformation.
What's wrong with the Murray analysis? I know you don't agree with it, but what's wrong with it?
Each of the three triggering events is wrong for separate reasons, and I'd like to take them in turn. The first is the receipt of the PIP fact sheet. The Murray decision, it undermines and negates the legislature's intent in creating the PIP fact sheet. The PIP fact sheet is a colloquial term referring to a particular form of notice that the legislature required insurance companies to provide to claimants pursuant to former CRS 104706-4B. The legislature recognized the asymmetrical knowledge base between the insurance companies on the one hand and insureds or claimants on the other hand, and therefore created the PIP fact sheet as a means of leveling the playing field and requiring insurance companies to provide to claimants information regarding claimants' right to PIP benefits. The point was the legislature saw that insurance companies were possessed of superior knowledge vis-a-vis their insureds or other claimants regarding the rights under PIP, and required the insurance companies via this PIP fact sheet to provide insureds with all of the knowledge, the relevant knowledge, that the insurance companies had. For the Murray decision to then say that upon receipt of this PIP fact sheet, a claimant is charged with superior knowledge relative to the insurance company as it relates to the insurance company's failure to have complied with its obligations under 710 of the former no-fault statute, runs directly counter to what the legislature was intending to accomplish by creating the PIP fact sheet to begin with, which was to ensure that insureds at least had as much knowledge as the insurance company. If the panel has no further questions about the PIP fact sheet, I'll move on to a discussion of the second event, which is the retention of counsel. The court below did not make any findings about which plaintiffs had previously retained counsel and for what purpose. That in and of itself is reversible error. Furthermore, there must be some sufficiently close nexus between the scope of the prior representation and the question of the adequacy of PIP benefits. If, in fact, knowledge of the law is irrelevant to a statute of limitations analysis and is only knowledge of facts that's relevant, then retaining counsel who has superior knowledge of the law is similarly irrelevant. Therefore, the only relevance to having been previously represented by counsel must be that prior counsel had engaged in a factual investigation into the adequacy of PIP coverage. Now, the Murray decision does not limit itself in that way, and the court below did not engage in any factual findings regarding the relationship between the prior representation and the question of expanded PIP benefits.
Let me ask you, sir, with respect to your bad faith breach of contract claim, from where does it commence? What was the first bad faith act by the insurance company in your complaint?
The first bad faith act was in knowing that it had violated its obligations under the statute and undertaking a campaign of concealment.
Well, doesn't it in fact say that the bad faith was when American Family failed to pay enhanced PIP benefits that were owed as of the date that PIP benefits should have been offered?
Yes, Your Honor, and that would have been further down the line. That would have been post-reformation. Once the contract had been reformed and the enhanced benefits were owed, any failure to pay those benefits.
Well, when was the contract reformed?
In 2007.
The Hicks case?
Yes.
All right.
If there are no further questions on the retention of counsel, I'll address the final event, which is when the PIP benefits are exhausted. What the Murray decision effectively does is charge a claimant with pursuing potential litigation against an insurance company at the moment the insurance company has fully and completely paid all of the benefits due under the contract. In other words, what the Murray decision says is that when an individual is armed with no knowledge of wrongdoing, but armed only with the knowledge that the insurance company has faithfully complied with its obligations under the existing contract, that at that moment, the insured is on notice to pursue potential litigation against the insurance company for failures that may have occurred months or years earlier in the original offer of the insurance product.
Doesn't it really say two things? It says, number one, you're aware of what the law is. And number two, you're aware that you're not getting paid anymore. And on the basis of those two facts, a reasonable person similarly situated would know they have a claim. I think that's what the Murray case says.
I think that as far as it goes, those are the assumptions that the Murray court made. I don't think that those are appropriate assumptions to make, Your Honor. Number one, both with this set of plaintiffs and with the larger group of plaintiffs out there in other cases, you have among them individuals who are not the insured, but who were passengers or who were pedestrians. And so they were not the original contracting party. And so to say that once the benefits have legitimately been exhausted under the contract, that such a person, because they're presumed to know all of the intricacies of the no-fault law, has enough information to investigate whether in the original contracting between the insurance company and a third party insured, there is some defect in the offer, is unreasonable and is poor public policy to encourage the investigation of potential litigation based on the faithful payment of monies owed under a contract. If there are no more questions at this time, I'll reserve the balance for rebuttal.
6 seconds. May it please the court, Peter Gregory on behalf of defendants appellees American Family Mutual Insurance Company and American Standard Insurance Company of Wisconsin. Mark Twain stated, quote, "The reports of my death are greatly exaggerated," end quote. I think the same can be said for Colorado's PIP law, which sunset in July 1st, 2003. Here we are 7 years later in 2010, and there are six appeals pending currently before this court raising similar issues to that in this case. And there are also about 15 suits pending in the district courts encompassing about 140 plaintiffs. The reason that I point that out, as I did in my brief and as I do in oral argument, is that this court's ruling, both on this case and on the case that you're going to hear next, will have far-reaching and significant impact on the viability of those cases. Now, I would note that in the briefs, the plaintiff purported to raise four issues. Only one has been addressed on appeal, so I will address on oral argument. I will address that first one, and then if the court has questions on the remaining issues. The four issues that were raised in the briefs, the first was the accrual for statute of limitations purposes. The second was whether equitable tolling was applicable here. The third relates in essence to the first, and that is the impact of the Hicks case. And the fourth is whether American Family was barred by issue and or claim preclusion from raising the defense of statute of limitations. Now, Murray is the standard to be applied by this court. But what is critical here is we're not simply looking at Murray in a vacuum. Murray was essentially the state appellate court counterpart to extensive federal court law that developed beginning in 2005, starting with the Tenth Circuit's decision in Nelson. And I've cited a number of those cases to this court, and indeed, the Court of Appeals, two separate divisions, one in Wagner versus Grange and then the Murray division, found the analysis of the federal courts concerning the accrual of extended PIP claims to be persuasive. So we cannot view Murray in isolation. Rather, we have an entire line of cases that construes all the various permutations of accrual of statute of limitations of extended PIP claims. Now, it's important to note that the Nelson case, which was the seminal case on accrual, said that there was essentially one accrual date. And that date was the accrual date for seeking the remedy of reformation, breach of contract, or other remedies. If we move forward to Murray, Murray is consistent with Nelson as to that accrual date. And indeed, the trial court, as well as this court in Murray, held that those claims, reformation, breach, other tort remedies, as well as concealment claims being asserted against Guide One and Murray, were barred by the statute of limitations. Plaintiff's argument essentially requests the court to ignore Murray and the established law. Now, I do want to address some specific facts because plaintiff identified three triggering factors addressed in Murray, the first being the PIP fact sheet. Let's be clear on what the PIP fact sheet was and was not. First of all, the statute that required that a PIP fact sheet be provided that at such point as a PIP claim was made, the insurance company would provide a fact sheet to its insureds describing the benefits to which the insured was entitled and the means by which the insured could apply for those benefits. Significantly, as this court held in Munger versus Farmers, and I've pointed this out in my brief, the PIP fact sheet law only required insurance companies to provide notification as to basic PIP benefits, not as to extended PIP benefits under 10.4.7.10. That's a significant point here because, in essence, the PIP fact sheet argument is a red herring from plaintiff's perspective because at the time that each of these plaintiffs made their PIP claims, they were in fact provided with a PIP fact sheet that said, you will be paid basic PIP benefits. Here's what they are, and here's who you need to contact to get them. The company at that point complied with the law, and indeed it advised the insureds of what benefits they were entitled to under the coverage that they had purchased.
And under the statute, if the insurance company does not comply with the statute to offer the enhanced benefits, doesn't the statute provide they have the enhanced benefits?
No, the statute does not provide that. The case law, and it's cited in the brief, and essentially it's the Thompson Shelter versus Thompson case and the Brennan versus Farmers case, provides that in the event of an insurance company's failure to provide with its statutory mandate to offer required coverage, the remedy of reformation to provide that coverage is an appropriate remedy. And if we, and once again, this is covered in the briefs, if we look at other cases that this court has announced, like the Soto versus Progressive case, this court has held essentially that, and this is going to tie into another point in a minute, but this court has held that there is no ipso facto reformation. Rather, reformation is a remedy that can be imposed by the court. And we're going to talk about Hicks.
Okay, so I'm wrong in assuming that the statute provides that there would be enhanced benefits. All that the statute provides is a remedy for the insured to secure the enhanced benefits.
No, there's really no remedy provided in the statute. The statute required that two particular options be offered, Judge Ney. And in point of fact, American Family had and did up through the sunset of PIP offer one of them, which was unlimited medical benefits. Where American Family fell short was offering the second option, which was unlimited medical benefits combined with wage loss, unlimited in time and amount. American Family did have some 14 optional coverages, but it missed the boat slightly on that second one. The statute is simply an offer statute. It's not a remedy statute. Now, one of the things that we heard in the opening argument here was essentially, let's look at what the insurance company did. The problem with that approach, and indeed that approach is rejected by Murray and the other cases, is that the focus is not on the defendant's conduct in determining the accrual date for the statute of limitations. The focus is on what the plaintiff knew or should have known
under the circumstances. So when plaintiff attempts to pull in the conduct or the knowledge of American Family, that's inappropriate in the analysis of when the plaintiff's claims accrued. With regard to the issue of retention of counsel, there was an assertion that there was no finding by the trial court in that regard. To the contrary, at page 3 of the trial court's order, the court notes that defendants had set forth in detail and supported by affidavits and exhibits the dates on which each of the 10 plaintiffs received notification explaining what basic PIP benefits they could receive, the dates in which each plaintiff ceased receiving those basic PIP benefits, and, when applicable, the dates in which the plaintiff retained counsel. The court will also notice at page 27 of my answer brief that I have specifically identified the exhibits where the underlying lawyers contacted American Family at the time these PIP claims were being handled and said, I am representing Mr. or Ms. So-and-so in connection with their PIP claim. So with that correction, the other correction that needs to be made is an understanding of what this case is about, and you'll be hearing this again in the next argument. And truthfully to the court, I've lived this since the filing of French in 2000, so I'm in year 10 of extended PIP. I've made a career out of it. But let us understand what this case was about. This case was about an assertion that American Family should have been paying extended PIP benefits from the date of each plaintiff's accident. In essence, Judge Ney, that the policies were ipso facto, automatically reformed as a matter of law, and the company should have been paying those benefits. That's the essence of the allegation. Now, what we heard in opening argument was, no, we're talking about post-Reformation claims. No, we're not. Here's the distinction. After efforts to get a class certified were rejected twice by the district courts, there was a class action called Hicks that was filed up in Boulder in July of 2004. And indeed, plaintiff's counsel represented Mr. Hicks in that class action as class counsel. That class action sought the limited remedy of reformation of the policy and notice. Ultimately, in November of 2005, Judge Sandstead in Boulder certified the class, reformed the policies of people who met the class definition, and then notice was sent out in 2007. Significantly,
the court ordered that the notice be given to all the other policyholders of that, right? I mean, that's why you sent out that notice, right? To comply with the court order, right?
Well, there's much more history.
Okay, never mind.
No, I'll answer that. I've got 3 minutes. As the court can see from the briefs, American Family, at the point in time when all class actions had been denied certification, which was in November of 2003, American Family made a determination that it wanted to do right by its policyholders. And at that point in time, it actually instituted a voluntary reformation process to address initially closed claims and then ultimately open PIP claims. And it was as part of that process that some 17,000 notices were sent out in May of 2004. Those notices were not all encompassing. They tried to get as many people as they could. The result was that Mr. Hicks filed a lawsuit. He had not received a notice. We've admitted that. And so when the notice went out in May 2007 as ordered by the Boulder court, that was in essence a subsequent notice, but that one was pursuant to court order. Now, what's significant is that Judge Sandstead said that people with reformed coverages
were obligated to contact American Family to have their claims under the extended PIP benefits adjusted. You will see as these cases progress, it's not really brought to the forefront in this case, but as these cases progress, you will see that there are instances that are currently out there up in Boulder where someone has come to American Family in, for example, 2010 and said, I am a member of the Hicks class. I submitted to you in February 2010 a claim under my extended PIP coverage, and you did not respond timely. That is a viable post-reformation claim, but we're not dealing with that here. There is no evidence and no argument whatsoever in the trial court or before this court that we're dealing with claims of that nature. Rather, what we are dealing with is an assertion that PIP benefits should have been paid in 1994 when Miss Jones had her accident and thereafter. And similarly, that PIP benefits should have been paid at a much earlier time. That's why, in many respects, as we've argued, Hicks is irrelevant here. Hicks does one thing, and we've said it in our brief. Hicks does provide members of the class with the coverage. And members of the class are entitled to get, in essence, an additional $70,000 in extended PIP benefits. Hicks does not serve, however, to revive claims which already expired under the applicable statute of limitations when you look at the accrual doctrine under Murray and the federal court cases. If there are no further questions, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to begin with Judge Nay's question about the effect of not offering the coverage initially. In Thompson versus Budget Rent-A-Car, the court says as follows. When an insurer fails to offer the insured optional coverage that it is statutorily required to offer, additional coverage in conformity with the required offer is incorporated into the agreement by operation of law. Unless there be any ambiguity, the court goes on to say here, because Budget did not offer supplemental no-fault coverage as required by statute, we conclude that such coverage was automatically incorporated into the agreement. Was automatically incorporated.
Mr. Rector, as I understand the complaint, it cites events that occurred after, it cites events that occurred before the Reformation.
Yes.
And the allegations are focused on the plaintiff's claims of entitlement to PIP benefits at a time when those PIP benefits were exhausted. So that if the cause of action accrued at some time prior to Hicks' Reformation and the statute of limitations expired sometime prior to Hicks' Reformation, you're out of luck.
That's right. That is right. Hicks cannot revive a statute that has already run. That's correct. What we're contending is that the statute had not run. In fact, in this case, did not begin running until 2007. That's correct. Now, I'd also like to address opposing counsel's description of Munger as it relates to the extent of notice that needs to be provided under the PIP fact sheet. The legislature passed 10-4-706-4 as the notice statute, and there are two subsections, subsection A and subsection B. Subsection A, which was the subject of Munger, relates to notice that must be given to an insured when an offer of coverage is made. Subsection B relates to what we're talking about here, which is providing a PIP fact sheet to a claimant when a claim is made on the policy. What Munger said is that the notice in subsection A
is limited solely to basic PIP because of language that was contained in subsection A that referred to notice of benefits under this section, the section being 706. And therefore, the interpretation was it didn't apply to expanded PIP under 710. That language is not present in subsection B. The extent of subsection B is an unsettled question of law. The legislature could have included it if it wanted it. It may apply to expanded PIP. Thank you.
Both. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. Case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.